So it turns out the translation of Caprice is actually Villefort itself. That's just perfect. That's just to say, Caprice is just to say the power to choose. The power to choose itself. Which also does have the connotation of Caprice, but Caprice is not a helpful translation here, because Hegel's absolutely depending on that Willkür should bear all the weight of all those Kantian and Fichtean associations with the will itself. It is just the name for subjectivity and will in Kant and Fichte. Okay, that's one of them. Well, how do I want to defend the notion of evil as an intrinsic feature of human action? That's what I need to do. And once that's done, then we can see that this confession of evil is the recognition of a kind of shared meaning for modern subjectivity. And that's what I've tried to represent, what I'm calling the continuum hypothesis. And the continuum hypothesis is a way of thinking about the different ways in which actions relate to existing community and others. So, since Hegel thinks actions are social, and that actions get their meaning by the way in which they are intended with respect to the community, and the way in which the community responds to them, then it seems right to say that a theory of action, this is the second aspect of what I'm calling Hegel's theory of action, should have a variety of ways of understanding how actions socially mean. And I take it the baseline for understanding how actions socially mean is what this means is a continuum of from no individuality, subjectivity, negativity, evil, to real evil. That's what the hypothesis is. And I'm suggesting that this is a way in which we can regard all human actions done by us moderns. So, the baseline that means differently in traditional and modern societies is what I call habitual or routine action. Our original notion of habitual routine action was Ismene, who did not act, who would not put herself in her action, who would not break the law, who insisted that the only actions one can do are those that are already legitimated or vindicated by the state. And what that comes to mean in conditions of modernity is all those actions we do all the time that are already fully socially coded, that are just part of, let's call it, the repertoire of possible actions for us as citizens. And those goes for all those expressions of saying hello, hi, are you, buying and selling items and goods. I mean, you know, just anything where the action itself, where the action ends up as particular and not singular. Right?
So this is the world of Heidegger's ready to hand. It is also without individuation. It is also the world of Das Man, because the habitual and routine can also be the hyper-conformist. So it has there's a lot of possibilities in here, right? But it's any time when the action you're doing, it doesn't matter so much that you're doing it. You're just doing the action that needs to be done, understanding universal. And probably it's true that a significant portion of what we all do is habitual and routine. You may say mimetic. It imitates these standing models of action. When we try to do these actions, we sometimes simply, unintentionally, by mistake, accidentally, do it wrong. And that's what I'm calling innocent trespass. Where I say the wrong thing on the wrong occasion, or I misunderstand the rules, or I sign the wrong form. So the ways in which, and the reason why I call innocent trespass as coming second is because with innocent trespass, it doesn't really infect the standing of the existing universals and norms. It breaks them, but didn't want to break them. It's not important to break them. It's happy to reinstitute them. We're all, the like. So this takes up the kind of standing social world. Now, nonetheless, we each are, in the modern world, we don't merely fulfill social roles. That, as we already understand, we have a reflective relationship to existing norms. We have a reflective relationship to the social roles we inhabit, and that therefore it is normal in conditions of modernity for us to take the repertoire of existing possibilities of speech and action and to try to give it our own style, our own personality, the shape so that that what we're doing, say in teaching Hegel, is not just teaching Hegel, but it expresses my individuality in teaching Hegel. And the same thing when you are writing an essay. You are not just, sometimes I will say, okay, we've got the text right, we said it all. Where are you in this essay, right? You've just kind of repeated the standard stuff. I want to see you appropriating it for yourself and then giving it your own characterization. So that we actually expect that even in this area, that when we come across it, we like to give it our own style, our own slant, our own little extra something, so that we are the conditions for the possibility of individuation is taking the existing norms, existing practices, existing materials that we have inherited and putting them together in a more or less unique way. We try to give them, and the possibilities of uniqueness turn out to be ones which entail, because we value this, that those universals themselves undergo routine, I almost want to say unconscious transformations. So if you want to kind of distinguish yourself, and you don't want to say just yes, you know, you're going to be the one who starts saying okie dokie. And then suddenly everyone's saying okie dokie, right? And a new universal has entered it. So you take in, you know, the notion of yes and okay and giving it a little thing, and then it becomes, well, this is Chomsky theory, right? Although Chomsky theory, if you've read the New Yorker, has been demonstrated by the Piran people.
Piran.
How are they pronounced?
Piran.
Piranga in Brazil. Falsified. The strange group of people who have no recursion in their language. It's a fantastic article in the New Yorker. It's a defense of neo-Wolfianism, and it's against the idea of deep structures and recursive grammars. It's quite stunning, and the Chomskyans are going crazy. Which, just in principle, I love. But, of course, the Chomskyan hypothesis is you get a basic repertoire, right? And by, you know, giving it your own twist, you automatically end up saying new things with a limited grammar. That's what Chomskyan's original hypothesis is. How from a finite base can you have infinite new sentences? And we say new things all the time. And that those things eventually generate new semantic possibilities in the language, almost at this point, the way I'm presenting it is incrementally. It's not that, you know. Now, sometimes what happens almost automatically, more or less, in steps 3 and 4, happens self-consciously. That is, someone says, look, there's something wrong with this practice. I don't like the way in which Americans are eating. And my name is Alice Waters, and I'm going to transfer the meaning of what it means to cook a meal and eat a meal. And she did. She innovated a whole idea of how foods should be prepared, where they should come from, what we wanted to eat. She changed our desires. I mean, so she innovated, right? And this innovation belongs, I mean, I use that kind of example just to make up with that notion of innovation can happen anywhere in our culture. That we do not, this was again part of Keller's argument, but she put it in the political. She said, we have the idea that, you know, that we can politically innovate, that we don't know what the possibilities of political communities are, of what the possibilities of laws will look like, of what sort of... So that we are the kind of people for whom existing universals, right, are subject to creative transformation because we realize that they are not a priori grounded, that they are creatures of history, that they have about them an inalienable contingency, which is to say they have about them an inalienable groundlessness, that there is no ultimate ground or foundation, right, that is sufficient to secure an unchanging or perpetual body of norms or ideas about any area of human practice. Whether it is how one, just looking around the room, how one wears one's hair, how one raises a baby, what it is to have eyeglasses, I mean, anything you can imagine, we think in fundamental ways is up for grabs, which is to say, could be better. Right? So we have some idea of better that is hypnotically indeterminate, Or to put it another way, we think that every universal is a determination of our will, something that has been determined to be a universal, and is subject to further redetermination. Right? So that the notion of determinacy for Hegel is the crucial one. And then finally, along this, is those acts that aim, right, simply at great and criminal misdeeds, at law-breaking, for, and the reason why this is last is criminal misdeeds are, of course, a confusion, and their confusion is this: they break the law for the sake of themselves without understanding their own legislative power. So they are, my claim is that criminal misdeeds is simply a deficient model of what appears all along here. But what criminal misdeeds reveal, if I'm right about how it fits into this series, is that we are talking about transgression, about negativity, and about subjectivity. That is, what the continuum hypothesis reveals is the unsurpassability of the moment of negativity, of the unsurpassability of singularity, and of the unsurpassability of transgression in the life of universals. What we're talking about here is the life of universals. Hegel's a philosopher. That's all he really cares about. Right? He's interested in universals, but he's saying, this is the life of universals. This is where it comes from. This is what sustains it. This is its ultimate, right, infrastructure. So this goes back to, I now want to say, and underwrites, dovetails with the analytic of action. Right? The analytic of action, remember, was the fallibility of our actions, problem of knowledge, and hence the problem of what action we've done, reproachability, consequences matter, interpretive pluralism, and the duality of action, namely as intentional and expressive. So evil for Hegel equals negativity, individuality, the right of personality. Therefore, it represents, in a certain way, Willkür itself. It's simply saying, this is what Willkür amounts to. The moment of Willkür cannot be surpassed. Which is to say, that in the confession of evil, Hegel, in a way, how do I want to put this? Is getting behind the notion of both original sin and radical evil in Kant's sense. It's not an accident he's using the word evil here. Because what he is suggesting, in opposition to Christianity and in opposition to Kant, is that evil is simply a word for finitude.
and because it's a word for finitude, and because there's no avoiding our finitude, then the confess evil is not the confess being outside of the good. It actually is an affirmation of the place of the human itself. So next week, when we read the account of Christianity, Hegel will say, and no one believes in it, including my friend Pippin, who when Hegel says evil is good. And of course, in saying that, he's making it as clear as, and this is how the end of religion and the end of this chapter connect up. So that's what you want to focus in. You want to focus next week on revealed religion. I don't have time to do all the other religions. So really focus on revealed religion, Christianity. I think maybe Miller translated it as manifest religion. And that play of evil there. And it is saying that we are, why finitude? Because it's saying we're historical creatures who institute new actions through, hence the model of criminality, transgression. Finitude and transgression are one and the same. That's the deep notion, yeah.
Why not finitude and infinite utility? So going back to the dialectic of pure insight of faith, there's like one section where Hegel ends up talking about the idea of religion for pure insight. The original sin is actually eating of the tree of knowledge that allows us to re-articulate nature. So nature is purely utility for us. And then the next paragraph, of course, is this is what throws faith back.
Right. So that's one of the reasons why religion comes back in. We haven't yet settled the problem of nature. And one of the things the religion chapter aims to do is to deal with the problem of nature without collapsing back into utility. Because we don't want a merely instrumental relationship to our own history. Right? That instrumentalizes everything. Why? Because we're also bits of nature. Right? This is why I didn't do the passage where, you know, the hero and the valet thing. But, you know, that whole business about the hero and the valet is, you know, you're evil because you're acting from your own passions. Right? And Hegel says that's what the valet would say. Now, what he means by that is, exactly what am I supposed to act out of? Someone else's passions? Where else does action come from but my passions? So of course I do an action because I care about it and I desire it. I shouldn't desire what I'm doing? I mean, right? So that for Hegel is the moment of nature in some sense, in all our actions. See, that he sees no problem that we have drives and desires and inclinations, right? That's another part of Kant's notions of radical evil. Remember, radical evil, by definition for Kant, is simply the inclination to choose, Willkür, the passions rather than the moral law. And Hegel's answer to that is, I shouldn't act on the basis of my passions. Of course, there's always a moment of individuality in an action. So to say that you're, you know, to accuse someone, oh, I know you're aiming to save the world, but you're getting pleasure from it, aren't you? Yeah. I like saving the world. Oh, then it doesn't count. Why doesn't it count? I mean, you know, this is supposed to be, we're supposed to be beyond our passions, beyond our desires. So that's the other sense here in which we are acknowledging that inelimitable moment of inwardness and subjectivity. And that's what Hegel wants here. So this, all of this I just said, this is what Antigone confesses. That's what she understands in the confession. That's what she sees when she sees that she and judging consciousness are the same, and therefore she's confessing, hey, I'm confessing my humanity and my finitude. And buddy, I don't, you know, bad news for you. You too are finite. And that's why I see, and I'm saying, of course I'm you. Of course I'm you. What else could I be? What else could I be? What else could anyone be?
Well, judging consciousness is not thrilled by the confession. This is the moment of the hard heart. And of course, the hardness of heart is both a trope
is it actually a trope in the Zavalos novel?
But it's certainly, of course, in the Bible, right? Where hardness of heart, stiffness of neck is the resistance to God, right? So Hegel says, paragraph 667, but the confession of the one who is wicked, evil, I am so, is not followed by a reciprocal, similar confession. Again, let me just point out, act of confession, I'm saying, I want to be clear about this, because it's what matters. The act of confession, just the performative, is her act of recognition. Right? This is her recognitional act of their similarity. So why, when I said to you this is not a... Hegel does this moment not philosophically but performatively, the performance is a performance of a moment of recognition. Right? So the confession, so the question is, how do we recognize one another? You know, how does recognition get going? And one of the ways it gets going is through confession. And the confession of any time anyone acts in any of these ways, especially 3, 4, 5, right? This is the notion of significant human action. My claim is, if you are aware of what you're doing, then in your act, you must be simultaneously confessing evil. Otherwise, you don't understand the meaning of your own action. That the notion of confession is, as I'm claiming, the lining of all significant human action, because all significant human action, under conditions of modernity, does not aim merely to break the law, but to transform it in productive and creative ways for a better justice, a better dinner, a better haircut. Right? But the confession of the one who is wicked, I am so, is not followed by a reciprocal, similar confession. This was not what judging consciousness meant. That is, when I said you're evil, I didn't mean confess you're evil and say I'm evil too. I wrote a book criticizing Habermas, right? He didn't talk to me for 10 years, right? Confessing evil, forget about it. No, he was the judge. This was not what judging consciousness meant, quite the contrary. It repels this community. And by the way, the of nature is not, I think, in the text. It just repels this community. And is the hard heart, that is, for itself, which rejects any continuity with the other. As a result, the situation is reversed. Acting consciousness says, I am guilty. Judging consciousness essentially says, I don't want your confession. I know you're guilty. I'm the one who told you that. Therefore, in a sense, the confession is rebuffed. That is, the claim to mutuality, the claim to reciprocity, the claim to a symmetry of recognitional standing is repudiated. That's why judging consciousness becomes the hard heart, and why now, so the hardness of heart is the final throw of the dice for a beautiful soul. And the question is the rebuff of acting consciousness, does it have any significance? Does it have any validity to it? Does it tell us anything? My argument is, it tells us everything. That this moment of the hard heart is actually the clue to the understanding of Hegel's theory of the meaning of recognition and why recognition is not a structure of mutuality, reciprocity, symmetry. So my claim is the hardness of heart is the clue to why Hegel is not the Hegel of any reading of Hegel I'm aware of. I'm claiming the hardness of heart is the refutation of every standard reading of Hegel. Here's why. You can make a claim. I was like a big claim. The hard heart was not totally morally corrupt in not accepting the confession. And the reason why the hard heart was not fully morally corrupt in not accepting the confession is because when I say, give you the whole puppy dog eyes, the whole thing, right? I have a certain expectation. I have more than an expectation. I think that in a way, confessing evil is kind of an act of cleansing. That if I'm willing to confess evil, if I'm willing to confess it was my fault, then God damn it, you ought to let me off the hook. So the notion of confession, you might say, seems to have built into it a implicit demand or even an implicit structure of inferential requirement that a sincere demand ought, all things being equal, to be accepted and forgiven. Well, what's wrong with that thought? What's wrong with that thought is if the confession is presumed to, what, logically, deontically, exactly why does it deserve to be forgiven? That is, if there's any sense in which the notion of forgiveness is required or demanded or normatively legislated as what is proper to the confession, then Platonism is true again. That there is a logic that governs the relationship between confession and forgiveness, and therefore forgiveness becomes another moral ought, right, that you ought to do when somebody sincerely confesses. So the fact that acting consciousness sort of tacitly, implicitly, all those sort of expected to be forgiven on the basis of that confession, right, shows that in the very act in which she was acknowledging the ineliminability of finitude and negativity, she was tacitly hoping that she'd be supported by a Platonic universal. That she wanted the recognition to be a moral ought. Right? That. So, what Hegel says is, so that the thought is something like, the other is obliged to forgive me, or I deserve to be forgiven. And the response here is, if we're going to be consistent, says who, white man? Who says you ought to be forgiven, you know? As if forgiveness is part of, again, a Platonic world of moral requirements, wholly independent of human action, human will, human institution. Now, so what acting consciousness, Hegel says, did not recognize, and I think these are his words, he says that she did not think that her action was one of self-abasement and throwing herself away. That I don't mean when I confess to be utterly throwing myself away, utterly self-abasing myself. But that's what a confession is. A confession is a throwing of yourself away and an act of self-abasement. That is to say that when you confess, you are taking a stand on nothing but your impotence, your lack of power. That is what confession actually reveals, is a moment of absolute dependency on the other. That is what the notion of confession really has stored up, and which wasn't there, it was implicit in the original confession, but not explicit, and only becomes explicit via the hard heart, is that in the act of confession, we are finally acknowledging our utter and irredeemable dependency on the other for our standing as self. And that there is no law, no universal, no norm, that nothing can ground or found or demand that I get recognized. And the reason why nothing can ground or found or demand or normatively legislate that I get recognized is because being recognized is the condition of possibility, of any possible norms or demands or entitlements you may eventually come to. So the revelation here is that recognition put it another way, no one deserves or is entitled to recognition because recognition is the condition of possibility of entitlement. If recognition is that, then everything else must follow from it, and it cannot be grounded. Recognition is not something you can earn. It is the possibility of anyone ever earning anything. So the relationship between a confession and the response to it cannot be based on any logic of any kind with any inferential powers. She thought that she was confessing her equality with the judge. And indeed she was. That's her insight. What she was overlooking was her dependency on the judge. When you confess, you are at the absolute mercy of the other. And therefore, you are beyond any possible discursivity and any possible logic. That's why I tried to bring in the notion of performativity here. And it's not an accident that it's a performance of confession. And it's going to be, and I guess we're not going to quite get there today, a performance of forgiveness. That forgiveness is, of course, always going to be. And now I want to say that very odd is sort of right, that in some sense every act must be unforgivable. Not because that you can only forgive the unforgivable, but I take it, my Hegelian reading of that phrase, you can only forgive the unforgivable, is that an act of forgiveness can never be deserved by the act. If the act absolutely deserves forgiveness, then you're not giving forgiveness, you're just, you know, following a social norm. When you give an act of forgiveness, it is, we might say, always and everywhere, logically supererogatory. More than what is required, more than your duty, more than anyone could ask. Which is to say that because of this absolute moment of dependence, there is a moment of non-reciprocity, asymmetry, and inequality built in every work of recognition. So get it thought out, and then we'll carry on next week. Yep.
Doesn't this just mark the difference between a logical reconciliation and a logical recognition? So insofar as when you want to reconcile, you can be reconcilable. We've just sort of switched motors. We haven't broken out of a logic, we just switched the kind of logic.
No, it's not a logic if you're admitting...
All right, here's the other way I want you to think about it.
Think about why a rent thinks that forgiveness requires vitality, why it's a beginning. Right? That the thought here is that forgiveness is always an act of spontaneity. It is always a new beginning in our relationship. And that is not something that is asked or required of me. It's rather something I give, because if I don't give it, then it's not forgiveness, it's something else. So, put it another way, we are absolutely responsible for ourselves. That there's a certain way in which we have to confess. We have to forgive. That's something we do, right?
any point we're not, as it were, doing it, then it's lost its meaning. It just becomes something else. We'll pick up with justice next week. I'll say more about the logic of forgiveness, and then we'll do religion.